We're with Harold Mueller, who lives in North Sioux City, South Dakota. Mr. Mueller, good evening, and thanks for joining us on Homefront South Dakota. Are you a native of North Sioux City?
No, I was born and raised over here in Menlo, South Dakota.
And is that where you were when World War II broke out?
I was in the CC camps.
Really? Which camp were you at?
Out at Belle Fourche, South Dakota.
What did you do while you were there?
Oh, we worked on irrigation project, manual labor.
How old were you at the time?
18, because 4 days after Pearl Harbor, I got discharged. I had my 2 years in. And then in 42, I turned 20, and then that's when I got drafted.
Tell me about that period when you got drafted. How did you find out, and where did you go for basic?
Well, first of all, we went to Omaha for physicals by the Army down there. And then we went back home for 2 weeks to get things in order. And then after that, we went to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And then from there, just a few days, we moved out to Camp Dare, Oregon. And we had 6 months there. It rained every day we was there.
Really?
Yes, it was in wintertime, you know. And then when we started getting some warm sunshine, they moved us over the mountains into the desert in eastern Oregon. We had 3 months of maneuvers out there. And then I came home on furlough. And while I was home on furlough, the outfit moved to Phoenix, Arizona for winter camp. And so I had to buy a two-way ticket to get home and then down to Yuma, Arizona. We had a blizzard. And of course, by this time I was living in Sioux City. We had a blizzard there. When I got off the train in Yuma, it was 98 degrees, all winter clothes on.
Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. When did you get word that you were finally going to head overseas?
Not until the following year. An early, real early spring, we did about 6 more weeks of maneuvering over in the Mojave Desert in California. Mm-hmm. And I come around the corner of a hill there, and there sat a train on railroad track. We got there, we loaded on the train, and went to Camp Carson, Colorado.
It sounds like you spent quite a bit of time doing training and maneuvers in the desert. Did you expect to go to North Africa, someplace like that?
By that time, that was all over with, you know. Another thing they were doing with us was we had a lot of new cadre officers, almost from top on down. So I think they were training them as much as they was us guys. So we didn't get over to Europe until after D-Day, Normandy.
Where'd you start out when you finally landed in Europe?
Well, we landed at Normandy on the beachheads there. And then went up through France in a couple of weeks, and then we caught up with whatever outfit we was. Well, I was with the 104th then. We finally run into where the combat was, and this one outfit was, they were British Army was in there, and they were dug in, and we came up, took their place, and he says, how's it going? Well, it's quiet as a church mouse around here. It didn't last long.
Didn't last long. Tell me about that.
Yeah.
Tell me about how it didn't last long.
Well,
what happened?
First thing we done was, after dark, went out on patrol. Needless to say, we run into an ambush, and our company commander got killed right off the bat. What he was doing out there on the point, nobody could figure out.
Because that wasn't his place.
No, not his place. But anyhow, he got killed, and one of my best buddies got killed. And he was a machine gunner. There's another, why would a machine gunner go on a patrol?
Because that was not common?
No, they got pulled back. I wasn't out on this patrol, but we heard all the commotion. And so they got pulled back, and then the next day we advanced and just more or less kept going until we got up there to Belgium. And then on Halloween night, we got captured.
Tell me about that experience. What happened?
Well, we made not really a river crossing. It was a canal, more or less, but we had to use boats to get across. I was with the point group, and we went on up a mile or two, and we run through some artillery and stuff, and even some of our own. Started getting dark, and we got orders to stop and dig in for the night. I don't think anybody come up behind us. Or, you know, our outfit wasn't following us. Because later that night, all at once, here come them German tanks and surrounded us guys where we were dug in at, and all we had was, you know, rifles.
Mm-hmm. Regular small arms.
Yeah, so, of course, we run out of that before they ever got there. So there was nothing to fight with except your bare hands.
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to fight a tank, huh?
Tell me what the circumstance was like when you were captured. Did somebody pop out of the tank? What happened?
Yeah, they just more or less come along there, some infantry along with the tanks. Mm-hmm. They come out, come up there and stick the gun down, come and see your house. And, you know, come on out.
Could you speak the language? Did you understand German at all?
I could understand a little, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my aunts and uncles and them used to talk German all the time. My folks did too, but not so much.
Do you think the fact that you understood the language helped you at all during your experience?
I don't know. It might have down the line, you know, in prison camp. Yeah, they start bringing these guys in, you know, they was picking them up. He was in a house. Pretty soon, by the morning, there was about 40 of us.
Mm-hmm.
Got out there and picked them up. Not all just from our group, but somewhere along the line.
Once you were captured, you were in Belgium at the time. What happened then?
Well, they interrogated us right there, some officers. Then at daylight, the next day, they marched us into town and loaded us on the boxcars and gave us a little piece of meat and a piece of bread. And they said, you better take it easy. That's got to do you for 5 days or more.
And really?
That's what we were. We was on them boxcars. Five days.
Where did you end up getting off the boxcar, and what did you see when you got off?
I really don't know where we got off at. But it was in four different camps. Be in there 1 or 2 days, and they'd give us some more food and get on them again and go a little further. And of course, sometimes they had to sit railroad yards or something for a while because air raids and stuff. Mm-hmm. They couldn't move. We went up through Berlin. That I know because we looked through the cracks.
Mm-hmm.
We was going through Berlin. Finally got to this American prison camp. All of them were sick. The guys had been there quite a while. A couple of days we was there, they fell out for reveille one morning, and they announced they want 40 volunteers to go to work. You get better food, all this and that, you know, make it sound pretty rosy. So I understood what they wanted. I turned to the guys behind me. I was in the first row. I turned around and I says, I think they want us to volunteer for work detail. And I says, I think we better go, because if you look around here and see the rest of these guys, we'll be just like them, you know. So as far as I was concerned, that was the best move I made. So they didn't waste no time. The next day we was on our way. Then they split us up into two groups, 20 men, two groups. We never seen them other guys again. And we went way up by the Baltic Sea, a little tiny village there, cafe and a couple houses, and that's about it. And then across the road from it was a barracks-like thing, with barbed wire fence around it.
What's the approximate date at that time? Did you know? Did you have any kind of idea?
Well, it was captured October. Probably a couple of weeks went by with different travels.
So you're October, November 44?
Yeah.
You're near the Baltic Sea. You could see the Baltic Sea. What kind of work did they have you do?
We were cutting trees. We were cutting big 40-inch pieces, you know, and whatever diameter, you know. We asked them what this was for, and they said, this was for their locomotives. Getting towards the end of the war, I suppose they were running out of coal. And
mm-hmm. How did they treat you when you were there?
Oh, we got along real good with them. We got plenty of wood to heat our barracks. We got potatoes and cabbage every day for make a soup. And then we got a loaf of bread a week.
What was your state of mind at the time? Because I would imagine it's October, November of 44. That's just about the time. Had the bulge started yet? Would it be accurate to say that?
Yeah, I missed the bulge.
Okay, so you missed.
That was in December, you know.
And that's happening while you're there. Mm-hmm. Did you have any sense of what was going on with that?
No, didn't know nothing about the bulge, I think, until we watched it on TV.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. We probably heard it mentioned a few times. We had no idea what it was, what they were talking about.
What was your state of mind at the time? I mean, was it I'm always curious to know, was it just a day-to-day thing, like this is what we had to do today and that's what you thought of?
Once we got in the routine.
Did you dare think ahead about what might be ahead?
No. We figured as long as we'd done our work here, we'd be sitting pretty good. We knew it was going to be over with before too long. So I go out and try to, be a hero. Get yourself shot up.
But you were pretty confident at that point and had a pretty good handle on the fact that it's just a matter of time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We could hear them bombing day and night, the Air Force. And then pretty soon we start seeing these Russian planes flying over and strafing. And then pretty soon we start hearing artillery. And our barracks was right along this road. And for weeks, 5 or 6 weeks, there was people coming from the east, refugees running from the Russians. Mm-hmm. On the other side, it was a block or so over, was a railroad line. And that was always loaded with guns and stuff that they were loading up to get away from the German or the Russians. Mm-hmm.
Now, you had mentioned that you had a pretty good feeling at that time that things were kind of going your way. Yeah. What about your captors? Were they getting nervous? Could you see anything in them?
No, didn't see nothing until the first day of May. The sergeant come to the door, and the first thing I noticed, of course, white armband around him. No gun. He always carries a pistol. Mm-hmm. No gun. He says, "You guys are on a holiday today. You don't have to work." I said, "Oh, okay." And I could see past him out there, and I see all kinds of people, soldiers and stuff that I'd never seen before, and armbands. Then he says, "Oh, by the way," he says, "the guy from the town just a little ways east of there that always brought the bread out to us." He says, "You know him?" I said, "Yeah." "Why don't you and another one of you guys go into town and get your bread ration for today, because he's, vacation too." So we walked, and pretty soon there was no more people coming. And then the next thing we seen, Russian tanks sitting around that town where we were supposed to go. And they were busy eating breakfast. We walked right up to them, and they just halfway ignored us, And so I just found an officer, and I says, "Where the Americans are?" He was eating, pointed east. "Oh, okay." So we went on down into the town then, and we found the bakery. We'd never been there before, 100 people lined up there waiting to get bread. And that guy seen us. He said, "Come see you." He gave us our bread, 20 loaves of bread. Here's all them people probably getting half of what they wanted. So then we went back out to the edge of the town where the tanks were, and they were gone. They started out then. They were gone. They moved on. Pretty soon we got to our barracks, and barracks was empty. The fence had been run down by the tanks, and all our stuff, everything was gone. It was stripped clear.
What'd you do then?
We run into some Belgians that were farm labor around there. They had a team of horses and a flat box wagon and several people and some of their stuff on there. And they were heading for Belgium and asked us if we wanted to ride. And I says, "Well, sure," because they were going the same direction we were. So it was with them a couple days, but didn't take long. The Russians stopped them and took away their horses and wagons and stuff. Of course, even before that, though, we had all this bread. When they told us they'd give us that ride, but we handed out that bread to us. Each just kept a little loaf of bread for ourselves. So we was walking along there, and we found a car and was going to see if we could get it started. Russian come along, took it away from us. Then we found some bicycles. We was going to ride the bicycle. They come along, took that away.
You're not doing very, I mean, you're doing well at this point, but everybody's taking away everything that you run into, it seems. The bicycle, the car, all your resources for getting back to where you want to be.
Yeah. So in order to survive, to have some food, German people see us walking, be getting towards evening. Come on, won't stay with us tonight. They figured that if the Russians walked in there during the night and seen us American GIs in there, they'd leave them alone. Well, it worked because they walked in several places where we were, didn't do anything. They just turned around and walked down. We finally got over to this bridge and big river, and it wasn't the regular army there anymore. It was just, the Russians with submachine guns on both sides of the road for about a half a mile up to the bridge. All the other civilians, the French, Belgians, and all of them, they turned them back. They wouldn't let them go any further. We walked towards the bridge, and you could just see them fall with them. Submachine gun, the old hair started backing on back of your head, and pretty soon we got up by the bridge. Lo and behold, there was the British on the other side. They, hey, come on, you guys, come on, come on. We didn't run, but we
stepped lively.
Yeah, we got over there, and boy, the most beautiful sight you ever seen.
What was that? What was the rest of that day like then?
First thing they done was they deloused us, took our clothes away from us and gave us some clean clothes because we was wearing them ODs, if you remember what them old army ODs used to be like, the winter uniform. Worked in them trees, the tree sap, and they just turned practically to leather. So they gave us all new clothes. Of course, we had all the same underwear on and everything. Of course, we washed that out by hand all the time when we could. Like I say, they deloused us, and then we got a shower and the clean clothes, and then they fed us. And the next day, loaded on the Lancasters, because there was just the two of us, because we'd gotten separated from the rest. Got on the British Lancaster, and I flew over the English Channel.
Oh, my. That must have been something.
That was quite a sight. And there was nobody in the gunner's seat, on the tail gunner. And I crawled down through that tunnel and got there and sat in that seat. All you could see was the little tip of the tail. That was it. So, man, you were out there by yourself. But it was great. So when we landed in England, then they turned us over to the Americans, had ambulance there, and they hauled us to the hospital.
How would you describe your shape at that time?
Well, not too bad, because we'd been working, all winter and eating enough to survive on, No meat. Once in a great while, they'd give us a can of meat to divide it up between 20 people.
Mm-hmm. One, I've read several stories of several men who were POWs during that time, and the word rutabagas kept coming up.
Got some of them, but they were always rotten. We wouldn't even eat them.
That's a theme I've often heard, that people, even if they said they never really had much of a taste for rutabagas from that point on.
Well, it took a while for me to get to eat it.
So did you ever hook up with your unit again?
No, never did. We went to that hospital for 2 weeks, had all our shots again, and they put a little meat on us, and then they went on a train down to London and reported to some office building there for interrogation. And then they told us that the place where they had army set up a, soup kitchen deal, for all the GIs that didn't have no regular outfit. The only thing you got to do is just come to this office and check the wall to see if your name's on a shipping list. So it was about 6 weeks we'd done that until we finally got on the Queen Mary.
On the Queen Mary.
Got on that thing, and in 4 days we was in the harbor, New York Harbor.
Well, what was that experience like when you saw the harbor?
That was great. And people coming out in boats and stuff, and bands on the boats, you know, and playing, and girls are dancing. And then they hollered over the Tom on the boat. And they said, "Guys, don't want everybody run to one side of the boat, you know, capsize us, because there's about 20,000 on there."
When'd you finally get home?
Well, got there, went into Camp Kilmer from the boat, and I think we was there just one day. And then went to St. Louis. Was there a camp there? I think there was something there, like a separation center or something anyhow. Was there a couple days, and they got her orders, got her papers, stuff, you know, got her back pay. Jefferson Barracks, I think they called it.
What was it like?
I had two months furlough, or, you know, they called it convalescence leave.
What was it like at home? It's kind of a silly question, but were they glad to see you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were glad. Yeah. My dad and mother were never too emotional, but I knew they were glad I was home. Yeah.
What was it like adjusting to being back? I mean, you've just gone overseas, you've been in battle, you've been captured, you've been working labor, all these things have happened, and all of a sudden you're back home again. What was that like?
Of course, my wife, now we weren't married yet. We'd been dating a little bit before, you know, I left when I was on the last furlough at home. I knew where her sister lived. The very next day, I went downtown Sioux City there to her, found her sister, and she let out a yell and gave me a big hug and right over to the phone and called her sister. And she was up at the Ravinia to her folks. She wasn't expecting me. Boy, she was down Sioux City on the bus the next day.
Awful nice surprise, huh?
Yes, it was. Very nice.
And you eventually got married then?
Yeah, first of December, August 1st.
My goodness, it's an awful lot to pack into a year, huh?
Yeah. And this whole month, just about a month that we were running around together there in Sioux City, we was on the streets quite a bit, you know, going up and down streets and everything. And I had my uniform on, and finally one day, two FBI guys pulled up in front of me. It was just before we got to an alley, they pulled up in front of me and, "Let's see your furlough papers." And I says, "I don't have no furlough papers, but will these do?"
What were they?
The convalescence leave papers. "Oh, well," he says, "we've been watching you around here for quite a while, you know, a couple of weeks. And we thought it was about time you headed back to your unit." I said, "No, sir, I got 60 days before I go."
Oh, that's great.
So it didn't bother me any.
Have you ever hooked up again with any of the men you were in camp with in prisoner of war camp?
No, never have.
Do you think about them?
Yes, I thought about it. And Lila, she isn't really my wife. But they put Mueller on her tag.
I know how that goes.
Yeah. And I says, "Oh, heck, leave it that way." Her daughter got on a computer one day. I gave her a list of some names I had. And she claims that she found some guys that could be, you know, that maybe, and got their phone numbers and everything. They want me to call them, and I haven't had the guts to call them.
Why do you hesitate? I'm just curious.
I don't know.
Is it a period that you just soon not go back to?
Yeah, I guess so. Although I can sit there and watch some war movies and POW movies and everything, and get a big kick out of them and everything. Once in a while, I'll sit there and cry.
What's this weekend experience been like for you?
Oh, it's been great. You see that Korea there?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's absolutely right. Now, weren't, that wasn't the end of things for you.
No.
Go ahead. No. Go ahead.
We got married 1st of August. And then I was transferred. I had a report back in, you know, after about 60 days. Went down to Arkansas. Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
I got shipped out to Vancouver, Washington. They made an MP out of me, uh-huh. in a transportation outfit.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And figured we'd probably getting ready to go to South Pacific. Well, it ended before anything like that happened. So then end of November, I got discharged. And I hitchhiked home, pocketed my travel pay, and hitchhiked.
What'd you do then when you got home?
Well, I went to school for a little bit, business training school,
mm-hmm.
for a few months. And
GI Bill?
Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm.
I didn't quite finish it out, so I went to work as bookkeeper for a couple of places. And then in 1948, some guy talked me into joining the reserves. Then in 1950, you know what happened.
Yep.
That's when the
reserves were called up.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about that experience.
The war started, June 5th or 6th or something like that, 1950. And just 2 or 3 days, I had a letter to report. Had to go to Des Moines for examination, you know, and mm-hmm. test and get enlisted back in and come home for 2 or 3 weeks. And I was on my way.
Now, you've been through the drill once before.
Yeah, so I went to Vancouver,
mm-hmm.
or no, Fort Hood, Texas.
Okay.
3 weeks, got our shots and some more training again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went out to San Francisco, and I don't know what happened there, but we were supposed to go out, you know, in a day or two, and we got held up there for 2 or 3 days. Still say it had to do with the election.
Uh-huh.
Because that was the mm-hmm. year for the presidential election, mm-hmm. I think.
Yep, 1950. Sure it was.
Because the day after election, we got our orders to move out to head for Korea.
How did that experience, once you were on the ground in Korea, how was the experience different from when you landed in Europe during World War II?
Well, for one thing, I couldn't understand a word anybody said.
mm-hmm.
And went in as a replacement, because it was right after they got the hell beat out up there at the Yalu River, or mm-hmm. how you call it, in northern Korea. And so they had a lot of casualties. So we came in as replacements, and I went into 2nd Division. So guys were awful cold to us. So we had about 2 or 3 weeks of training, you know, with everybody together, you know, to get used to each other. And after our first battle or encounter, if you want to call mm-hmm. it that, the guys kind of changed their mind. The World War II guys were pretty good soldiers. So from then on, we got along real good. I was a mortar, a little 60-millimeter mortar section.
Mm-hmm.
First time went to fire on them things, them guys that had on their gunners, they couldn't level up they couldn't hit the broadside of a barn or whatever you say.
Uh-huh.
And the officer told me to try it. And I went up there and fire. They hit the target, which was unusual. But when we got back in off of that trip, he made me section leader. I never got the stripes, because when I got orders to come home, he says, "Well, I put you in for a sergeant." And I said, "You took long enough to do that." So I said, "You know what you can do with them sergeant stripes?"
Yeah. Sergeant's nice.
I'm gone.
Holds better. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
So then, and about what time was that? Had it been a year or more? Or?
Yeah, I had close to a year over mm-hmm. there, you know. Between the time it took to get home, it was a good year. Because when I hit the States, when I left there, I was the only one left from our company. Picked me up at the right there on the front line. Well, we wasn't right on front line then. And he took me a little ways down the road. They had an airplane there, cargo planes, you know, had the back end was open with the double tail.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I seen two of them get shot down one day by our own artillery. Got on that and I flew down to Pusan, and I got off of that one. Then I got on another one and flew to Japan. And then I got on the boat, landed up to Washington, Seattle, and hung around there for dang near 12 weeks. They couldn't find my records. They'd lost the records in Korea, so they had to get new records from Washington.
I have a feeling, just by the look on your face, that was a long 12 weeks.
Yes, it was.
And then you were home?
Yeah.
Home to stay?
Got home. Walked into the house, and my wife and the two boys were in there, and I just said, "Hi, boys," and went over and grabbed my wife and was kissing her, and the boys took off running. They run over to Grandma's house and said, "There's a soldier in there kissing Mama, and I think he's our dad." they weren't too sure.
How old were they at the time?
One and four.
Just little guys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, one and three, because they were just 2 years apart.
Do you think that there's anything, set apart's tonight, not the right word, but is there anything that bonds together guys like you who were in World War II and Korea? Is there anything that's unique about it? Anything that you feel special about it, or when you run into to other guys who were in the same boat?
Well,
is it just
I really
a little
haven't
different?
Run into any. They say there's some here, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't really talked to them.
Well, thanks for sharing all the stories. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think that's enough.
That's quite a bit. Harold Mueller, thanks a lot. Thanks for sharing the story. Thanks for all your service. And thanks for coming for this weekend. It really looks like it's something special. Very good. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.